If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism.
Well, welcome back to the Considering Catholicism podcast. I'm Greg, your host, and I am here again with Corey.
Hello again.
And we are continuing a conversation in response to a listener, a young man named Caden, who wrote in a pretty exciting question because he wanted to know all about warrior monks.
Yes.
And so during the Crusades, there were these religious military orders, and we're going to talk about them today, that, well, went off and fought the Crusades. So they were like fighting monks. It's pretty cool. And in our last episode, if you look it up, it's an episode titled Those Who Work, Those Who Fight, and Those Who Pray. We had a conversation sort of setting up this episode. So really, this is kind of warrior monks part two, although we didn't
talk about them specifically last time.
Right, because the purpose of our last conversation was to sort of set up how and why there were warrior monks. Because like we said last time, it seems like a weird idea to the modern mind that there would be these Catholic religious orders that they were fighting knights.
Yeah, and it's not really, doesn't make sense from our modern standpoint.
Right. In fact, you would say, well, if you went back to the early religious orders like Saint Benedict, he wasn't a fighting monk. Mm-hmm. And then later on, like today, we don't think of monks as fighting monks, but there was a period where there were some religious orders that were the military religious orders. Mm-hmm. And as we said in the last conversation, you have to understand how the Middle Ages developed, how over almost 1,000 years, this concept of the three-part society, those who work and those who fight and those who pray, developed. And then, like we said, when the Crusades arose, out of that society's, what, Corey, mindset, worldview,
structure,
template, you know, social constructs, kind of how that society worked, part of the response to the challenge of the Crusades was to take those existing ideas, those who pray and those who fight, and sort of merge them in a couple of instances.
Yeah, which makes sense because you have to have kind of a firm grasp of the rules and the categories before you can start being creative with them and responding to new situations, which is what happened with the orders we're going to talk about today.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we think about how we respond out of our society today, we live in a society dominated by nation states. So we tend to think of militaries as an extension of a nation state.
Well, government, yeah.
Government, nation states. That's just how the modern world works. It's how we think. We don't think of private armies. We don't think of...
Or if they are, they're based out of like a corporation or something.
Well, that's employed,
yeah.
Right? Contracted by a nation state. So, again, today, things that seem natural to us about how these things would play out, it was a different world in the Middle Ages. So let's get back into this. Go back and listen to that last episode, dear listeners. Those who work, those who fight, and those who pray. It's the previous episode to this one in the archive, and that'll set us up. And that brings us now to getting to the good part, the fighting monks, Caden's original question.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Corey, you want to talk a little bit about how those came about with the calling of the First Crusade and such?
Yeah, I can give a rough historical sketch and feel free to chip in when necessary. And we did an episode on the Crusades as such a while back, so people can go to that for more detail or do their own research. So you're getting towards the High Middle Ages. So this is like the 10th, the 11th century. And for about 500 years at that point, Muslim armies, in this case, mostly the Ottoman Empire, have been pushing into Europe on several fronts, through Iberia, so Portugal and Spain, into France, on the Mediterranean. There's a lot of naval action and piracy from Muslim sources on the Mediterranean. And then the Holy Land, and then up into what is now modern day Turkey and Greece. You have the armies of the Caliph invading Europe and trying to impose Islamic society on those areas. And so this is an existential threat, not only to Europe itself, but to the Holy Land, and specifically to pilgrim access to the Holy Land.
Yeah. Just to jump in there, Corey said, this has been going on for a while. So as we mentioned in the last episode, one of the most famous battles of the era was 732, the Battle of Tours, which is about 100 miles or less from Paris. Yeah. And Islamic armies, caliphate armies had, as Corey said, come up through Spain, over the Pyrenees, and were pressing through central France, driving to take Paris. And it was Charles Martel, who was the grandfather of Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor, and his Frankish armies actually beat back the Islamic invaders at the Battle of Tours 732, less than 100 miles from Paris. Mm-hmm. So to Corey's point, by the time you get to the middle of the 11th century, because the First Crusade is launched in
1095, 1096.
So by the time you get to that point, they had been fighting these Muslim armies off for 300-400 years.
Yeah, this wasn't new, but the new thing, or perhaps the increase in urgency, was pilgrimage access to the Holy Land.
So let's just talk about that real quick. The Islamic armies, the caliphate, which is basically the political organization of Islam at that time, you might think of it as almost like the Islamic Empire, the caliphate. They had taken, as Corey said, much of the Mediterranean coastal lands, but the Holy Land, meaning Jerusalem and the holy sites, Bethlehem.
Roughly analogous to Israel today.
Those holy sites were protected by the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, or Byzantium, and which was headquartered in Constantinople. And they still had control of the coastal lands and the holy sites in Israel. Mm-hmm. So while the caliphate had taken much of everything else around the Mediterranean, those pilgrimage sites were preserved, and Christian pilgrims could still travel through Constantinople, down through Antioch, and what we now think of as Lebanon, and into Jerusalem.
Which they did from all over Europe.
And what had happened then, as Corey says, is that at a certain point in the middle of the 1000s, right? We think about the 900s,
1100s,
the 1000s. Then what happened is Islamic armies took Jerusalem and several of the key holy sites, and they began to restrict the access of Christian pilgrims to visit those sites. And that was then the tipping point.
Yeah, it was a sort of straw that broke the camel's back
Because all of a sudden Christendom said, we can no longer access the holy sites, we can no longer send pilgrims, people can't go there and pray. Muslim armies have seized Bethlehem and Jerusalem and all of these things, and so we have to do something. We have to retake those sites and reopen access to those. And again, if you go back and listen to our previous episode on the Crusades, we explained all that. But in 1095, 1096, the Pope called for a crusade, a military exercise to retake those holy sites. It was not to wage war on the caliphate. It was not to wage war on Islam everywhere. It was very specifically tied to regaining pilgrim access to those sites and control of those pilgrim sites. And he calls for Western Europe, the Western Roman Empire, to respond and to organize a military response.
Yeah.
And that brings us to kind of what we were talking about the last episode. The medieval mind, that society, says, okay, how do we do that?
And initially it's a response out of that category of those who fight. So, I mean, there was a robust response to the Pope's call for a crusade, armed men, you know, from the noble classes down to the peasant classes from all over Europe responded to this call. And so armies went to the Holy Land. They were actually successful in taking back Jerusalem and a lot of that area. And then you had to maintain it. And it's not as if the caliphate was just going to leave you alone at that point. And so it's in that set of circumstances that you get these first, at least the first major orders like the Templars and the Hospitallers.
So let's talk about those.
Yeah.
Okay, in specific. There are three basically military orders, or primary military orders. And when we keep saying order, what we mean is a religious order that had a military purpose, or a military that had the character of a religious order. So our fighting monks.
Yeah.
Now, there are three primary groups of them. The Hospitallers, the Order of St. John, the Templars. Their official name was the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon, and the Teutonic Knights, also known as the Order of Brothers of the German House of St. Mary in Jerusalem.
So they all had long names, and then, of course, nobody uses them, so they get shortened. And there were a lot of smaller ones, too, but these are the big guys.
So let's talk about those. The Hospitallers were actually founded in 1070 before the First Crusade as a hospice or hospital in Jerusalem for pilgrims. Mm-hmm. So prior to Jerusalem falling to the Muslims, when pilgrims would visit there, I mean, obviously they would get sick and injured and all those kind of things. And they called it a hospice or a hospital. That words were kind of interchangeable. Mm-hmm. We think of hospice today as only a place where people go to die. But of course, in those days with the medical technology, a lot of times the hospital was a place where you went to die. But anyway, that concept of a place for sick travelers.
Right. Think hospitality.
Yeah. And this was a place where the ill and injured and infirm who were pilgrims visiting Jerusalem and the holy sites could get care. And so this group, the Hospitallers, the Order of St. John, is founded there.
And so this is a religious order. They pray, and then they do their charitable work.
Right. Now, at first, in 1070, they didn't have a military aspect to
it.
But they evolved into a military order within the next 100 years or so. Why? Because as the pilgrims were coming and Jerusalem fell, increasingly, well, the pilgrims were falling under attack and the hospitals were falling under attack and they needed security. So they took on a military function. There were fighting men who came and said, look, I'll help you. I'll provide security. And this sort of natural thing occurred to them, like, well, why don't I, in a sense, join your order and give you my sword? Mm-hmm. And I'll live with these Hospitaller monks, the Order of St. John. I'll pray with you, I'll live amongst you, I'll take the religious vows you take, but my vocation, my skill is going to be providing security and defense of the hospital and the pilgrims who visit here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there would be a diversity of roles within that. Not every Hospitaller would have been a warrior. Some would have, you know, manned the hospice.
Right.
But the sort of the thrust of the order increasingly went in that military direction.
Yeah, because they were under, you know, constant threat and attack during this period of conflict. And so, yeah, the order sort of evolves. And you kind of see that a fighting man felt that he was doing the Lord's work. He was protecting the pilgrims. He was protecting their hospitals, their sites, their rest houses. He was defending the city and where those forts were. And he took up military arms, but he would live according to, you know, he'd pray the liturgy of the hours. He would take vows of chastity, obedience, and
poverty.
But his skill was to be a fighting man. So that was the Hospitallers. Mm-hmm. Now, eventually, the Hospitallers changed their name. Mm-hmm. As the Crusades went along and eventually the Crusaders, all of the Crusaders, lost control of the Holy Land.
Yeah, the kingdom, the Latin kingdoms in Jerusalem and the Holy Land lasted a few hundred years and then were taken back by
And when they
Muslims.
Were taken back, the Hospitallers at that point fell back from the Holy Land to the island of Rhodes, which is off Greece. So you can sort of see that. It was just west of the Holy Land in the Mediterranean And they vacated those sites when those last forts and locations a couple hundred years later were lost. And they set up on the island of Rhodes to defend shipping and all these kinds of things. And then they lost Rhodes. There was a very, very famous battle where the Muslim armies and navies defeated them in Rhodes and they fell back to the island of Malta. And then they were under a great attack, and there was a massive epic battle in the 1500s when Muslim navies, the Ottoman Empire at that point, fell on the Hospitallers on Malta and these forts they had there. Epic battle. Right around, it was like within 10 years of the Battle of Lepanto. And from that point on, they won that. They defended Malta. They didn't lose it. Epic kind of defense, kind of like the Alamo, only they won, right? And they fought off the Muslim armies. And from that point on, that order became known as the Knights of Malta. And they're still known as that today. Although today they've dropped the military aspect and they're basically a charitable organization that still exists today and answers to the Pope. They do all kinds of fundraising and charitable works around the world.
And that took, you know, hundreds of years for that evolution as the changing political and religious landscape of Europe. But yeah, as you say, they're still an order, they're an international order, and their work is primarily charitable.
Yeah. So of these military orders that we're discussing, they're the only one that still exists, mm-hmm. and they're known as the Knights of Malta or the Order of St. John. And yeah, they do all kinds of work. Like you say, charitable work. They do a lot of like disaster hospitals, medical clinics and things all around the world. They still have that essential medicine mission of sort of caring for the sick and infirm.
Well, they're an interesting anomaly too, because like the Vatican City State, they're actually their own sovereign entity that's recognized by many, if not most, of the sovereign nations of the world. Even though they don't have a territory anymore, they're not on, you know, Malta any longer.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think they may have like a building in
Malta. I'm sure they have buildings.
But yeah, they're recognized in some. They have this weird kind of status as kind of like a sovereign not like a nation, but like a sovereign entity. Mm-hmm. And they have this interesting relationship with the Vatican and the Pope. So anyway, that's a whole thing. But that was the Hospitallers that became the Knights of Malta, and today are still the Knights of Malta, the Order of St. John. The next one was the Templars. These are more famous. Mm-hmm. People think of the military orders and they think of the Knights Templar.
Well, and there's all kinds of like apocryphal and legendary stuff about them, which we'll get into why.
Oh, but. And they show up in like crazy novels, like Dan Brown novels and everything as, you know, the Knights Templar. And mm-hmm. what was that movie about with Nicolas Cage?
Oh, were they National in, Treasure? Were they in that? Because they're in the Indiana Jones movie, right?
Crusade? Well, they're like every conspiracy theory about Western civilization always has the Knights Templar in the mm-hmm. background doing all kinds of conspiracies, right? But the Templars, let's get into that. They were founded in 1119 after the First Crusade. Mm-hmm. And their specific aim was protecting Christian pilgrims traveling to the Holy Land. So the same idea. You had pilgrims that are trying to go back and forth. And this, by the way, we got to keep on back. This is a real important thing. It has always been important, mm-hmm. even to this day. I mean, this is March. 1 year ago, I was on a pilgrimage in Jerusalem. Christians have always wanted to go to holy sites, go see Bethlehem and go see the sites in Jerusalem, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
If you're not going to go there, there's just immense spiritual and symbolic value to this is the place where Christ lived and died and rose again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Christians have always wanted to travel to these places. And the ability for them to have access to go to these was a huge deal.
Yeah.
And the notion that Christians could not even visit the place where Christ was born and died and rose again was an intolerable idea. And I think it would be intolerable today if you thought that mm-hmm. Christians weren't allowed to visit the Holy Land anymore. So this military response came about, and as the pilgrims were going back and forth in 1119 after the First Crusade, it still was dangerous because mm-hmm. the First Crusade established some control over it, but there were bandits and raiders and Muslim raiding parties.
Well, and you things. Have to get there too.
You have to get there. You have to land at the port of Acre or wherever you were going to put in. And then you had to travel the roads up to Jerusalem, and along the way you could be attacked. So the Templars were formed to basically patrol those roads, to establish forts along the way and things mm-hmm. to keep pilgrims. Now, they gained formal endorsement from the church, from the Pope, in 1129, who recognized that they had this pivotal role. And again, it came out of this notion of fighting men who believed they were doing the Lord's work. So out of this, we talked about in our last episode, out of that template for society, you say, I'm a fighting man. You know, I've got a sword and a horse and I know how to use them. And I want to, you know, provide holy service to pilgrims and to the church and to protect these pilgrims. And it naturally occurs to me, because I'm doing something holy, that I want to take a religious vow mm-hmm. to provide this. And so I'm going to take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. I'm going to, you know, pray the liturgy of the hours, and I'm going to live that way. But, you know, I'm a monk who, instead of brewing beer, protects pilgrims.
Yeah. I don't know if we mentioned yet, but the name Templars, their original foundation in Jerusalem was, I think, just adjacent to where Solomon's temple had been.
Right.
And so that's how that name became attached to them.
Yeah. As we said, the official name was the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon. So this was on Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The Temple of Solomon, of course, was the first temple. You know, the Temple of Herod was the second temple or whatever. But they were looking back at sort of historically the founding of being there. And yeah, and if you ever are blessed to visit Jerusalem, you'll see how right around there, adjacent to those precincts, there were a lot of crusader spots. To this day, when you go to Jerusalem, they'll say this building or this thing in Jerusalem was a crusader fort, or this was a crusader building, yeah, or a crusader church. And so they set a lot of those things up, and they took their name from basically allowing people to visit the site of the original temple.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, let's stick with the Templars, mm-hmm, for a second, because they had sort of an interesting history. So not only were they good at fighting, but let's go back to thinking about the pilgrims. Mm-hmm. So suppose you were from England or France or whatnot, and you were going to go on pilgrimage to the Holy Land. You wanted to go see where Jesus was born and died and rose again. And, you know, that was a long, difficult journey throughout Europe and on ships and getting there. But you needed to have money.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you get there, you've got to pay for lodging and food.
And on the way.
And on the way. But then you go, well, what am I supposed to do? Take a giant bag of money with
me? On the highway with all the bandits.
Yeah, and on ships and stuff. Like, I'm just going to get robbed. So what happened is the Templars began to open up these, I don't know, lack of a better word, offices around Europe. And you could go to one of those offices and say, I'm going to be traveling to the Holy Land, and I'd like to put some money on deposit with the office in London or Paris or wherever, right? And then they would record, okay, Corey deposited 1,000 gold pieces or whatever it is, right? And he has that in his account. And then they would give you a piece of paper, you know, sealed or whatnot, so that when you, along the way, or when you get to the Holy Land, you would go to one of the Templar offices or forts and show them the piece of paper and say, I put 1,000 gold coins or whatever it is on deposit in Paris. Now when I get here, I'd like to draw that for my spending, right? And then the Templars would, you know, kind of organize that as an international organization. So essentially it was like an early form of banking and deposit and credit system. Well, here's the thing. They were really good at defending the pilgrims and really good at fighting, and we'll get in that in a minute. But they also developed this pretty sophisticated banking system, and there was a lot of money being deposited in their banks and their credit system, and they got really wealthy from doing that. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, wealth and money can lead to corruption.
Yeah.
And over time, the Templars became so wealthy that many of the secular governments of Europe started to become concerned. There was this, you know, this Templar order, and they were rich because of all of these deposits. Yeah. And you had Templars who worked in the offices of London and Paris, and they weren't fighting guys. Right. You know, they were just guys who like lived in London and Paris and were part of this very, very successful, what's the word, like corporation?
Yeah, it's like an international banking conglomerate.
Yeah, banking conglomerate, a corporation that was super rich and wealthy, and it started to lead to corruption. And that corruption, there was charges of financial abuse, there were charges of sexual corruption, right? Because guys were living it up, and maybe they had these vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and they weren't maybe following all of those.
And of course, a lot of those accusations were probably, some of them were true, some of them weren't, but
Well, in particular, with the Templars, one of the problems is that they kind of ran afoul of some secular leaders like the King of France and others who sort of became jealous of them, or they weren't playing nicely together. And so those secular leaders went to the Pope and said, these guys are corrupt and bad and
doing all these horrible things.
Horrible things. And then there were charges of them, and I don't know how much they're true or not, but charges of them being, you know, having pagan worship and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of it is, it's hard to assess hundreds of years later because you don't have the evidence anymore. I think it's pretty clear that a lot of those charges were made up because the King of France wanted the money, which isn't to say the Templars, you know, there wasn't corruption or anything, but some of the accusations were pretty wild. And I think it's safe to say that some of it was made up as a pretext to get the gold.
Yeah. And, right. I mean, this is the whole thing about history is written by the winners or whatever. And there were all of these charges against the Templars. As Corey said, some of them were really wild. They were doing like satanic black masses and, you know, stealing all the money and who knows. But basically all of those charges stuck, or at least those were the historical documents, and eventually the Pope suppressed them. Mm-hmm. So they were basically put out of business by the Pope, and there are no Templars, except in Dan Brown novels and stuff like this, because, right, this is the great conspiracy theory about the Templars, is that they went underground and they've been behind every conspiracy in the West and all of the Crusader money. Like, remember that movie with Nicolas Cage with National Treasure?
Yeah,
or something?
Yeah, it was awful.
And then they go under that church in New York City and find all the Templar gold and everything like that. Like, it got a little bit wacky, right?
Well, yeah, and most of that, or if not all of that, is purest fiction. I mean, a lot of the wealth went, you know, straight into Philip of France's pockets, or was absorbed into the church, or like a lot of their infrastructure and religious brothers were transferred to the Hospitallers.
And so, yeah, so that was the Templars. And then the third group was the Teutonic Knights, the Order of the Brothers of the German House of St. Mary in Jerusalem. They were founded in 1190 during the Third Crusade, and initially also to aid sick and injured crusaders in the Holy Land. So they weren't so much focused on the pilgrims as they were focused on other crusaders and people fighting there who got sick and injured, and the Teutonic Knights would, you know, protect and defend them. Eventually, as the Crusades sort of wound down, these Teutonic Germanic Knights, this order of them, basically expanded their mission and moved up into Eastern Europe, because there were parts of Eastern Europe where the Muslim armies were pushing up through Eastern Europe. And then there were also other kinds of pagan and barbarian armies.
Yeah,
still at the time.
Think what now is modern day Lithuania and Eastern Poland.
The Baltics,
The Baltic states.
And so they kind of relocated up there and became these Teutonic Knights that were fighting wars and defending the borders of Christendom up there. And then over time, they just, I think, fizzled out. They're no longer an existing thing.
Yeah, I mean, history in Eastern Europe just kind of moved on. There were issues with how those campaigns were being run, and you had the development of nation states like Poland and Lithuania over the centuries. And I mean, in the end, those peoples were Christianized. So, and the Muslim invasion was beaten back. So yeah, there wasn't really a purpose anymore.
Now, what I want to talk about, now we've sort of laid all that out, and getting back to Caden's original question about, like, well, like, you know, where did they come from and what do they do and what happened to them? Mm-hmm. I want to talk about why they were so awesome. And what I mean by that is you can't understand how effective these guys were. So if you research this, you start finding out that, number one, there never were that many of them. Okay, if you go back to, they say, the Knights Templar, here's one statistic I found, that at the height of their power, like at their maximum, there never were more than about 15 or 20,000 of them in the Holy Land. Now, they were fighting off Islamic armies that numbered in the six figures, hundreds of thousands.
And they weren't the only guys there, of course.
No, but they were man for man, pound for pound, so effective. And the same with the Hospitallers, and the same with the Teutonic Knights. If you go back to the height of all of these military orders, they were, from every source that I've been able to check, outnumbered 10 to 1, 15 to 1, 50 to 1, 100 to 1, and yet they managed to hold that territory for hundreds of years. So the question is, why were they just so effective? And it comes down to, from near as what I can tell, a number of things. So let's start first of all with the guys themselves. You had, coming out of Western Europe, especially in northern France, like the Normans, the Norman armies, these are guys who were just really good at war. And for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, centuries, they had been fighting each other. So the First Crusade occurs within a generation or so after the Norman invasion of England.
Yeah, about 30, 35 years later.
Yeah, after William conquers England. And the Norman knights had been fighting each other in France. They'd been fighting the English. They'd been fighting the Saxons. They'd been fighting everybody. They had beaten off the Muslims at the Battle of Tours 300 years earlier. So you're talking about three, four centuries of these guys fighting constant warfare and against Muslim armies. And it's just like you had, they were just really, really good at war.
Yeah, they got it down to a science at that point.
They were just really effective fighters. And if you look at the Normans, when they came out of there, they went and conquered Sicily and Italy and all these things. So pound for pound, man for man, one of these Norman knights was worth, and the Normans were primarily, I mean, maybe they, the bulk of a lot of these orders, they were the most effective fighters in Europe at the time, in Western Europe. You know, it's like a modern analogy might be, if you look at our modern wars today, you know, we have Navy SEALs and Delta Force and all these things. And you can say, when you see in the Navy SEALs into, you know, wherever, Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, one group of, you know, 19, 20 Navy SEALs, a squad or whatever they are, a Delta Force, will fight off thousands of Taliban guys because they're just that good. They're that well-trained. They're that effective. And really, these military knights, the Templars and the Hospitallers and whatnot, were really, really good fighters like that and had been honed and trained. The second thing is they had better technology. So again, you might say our Navy SEALs or our Delta Force, not only are they individually incredibly well trained, the selection process, the training and all that, but also you give them the best tools. So the military orders like the Hospitallers and the Templars had armor and swords and horses that were just better than a lot of the Islamic fighters that they were facing in the Holy Land. Again, they had spent hundreds of years in Western Europe perfecting cavalry, horses, you know, plate armor, weapons. They had the best armor, the best tools, the best training, everything else. And then the third thing is that they had developed over hundreds of years in Europe was expertise at building fortifications.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a big deal.
It was huge. So when you go to the Holy Land to this day, you can find all of these forts that they built everywhere. And again, they had been doing the same sort of thing throughout France and the Low Countries and Germany and into Spain and in England and fighting the Saxons and fighting the Vikings and fighting each other. And all that was based even on Roman technology of fort building, you know, that had been handed down for 1,000 years. And so when you go to the Holy Land, you'll find these crusader forts or what's left of these crusader forts. And they were smart. They knew how to do this. They were, they knew how to build them, how to build a really effective defensive fortification, and they knew where to place them. They were placed strategically so many miles apart. And, you know, you could have, you know, reaction forces. You could have 10 or 20 of these guys in one fort, and then a couple miles down the road is another, you know, like, what do they call them? And we call them in our military today, like these forward operating bases and stuff in Afghanistan, right? And so you've got these fire bases and forward operating bases where you spread people. And if something goes off over here, you can shift forces here and there. And the Crusaders were really expert at building these kinds of fortifications and placing them strategically. And they had great tactics. They knew how to swarm out. So if a group of pilgrims was being attacked by Muslim bandits, 10 or 20 of these guys would come out of one fort and the other one with their skill, their training, their tactics, the cavalry that they had, all of these things, they could beat back these guys. And it's amazing how the Crusaders in general and the military orders in particular were so incredibly effective at taking and holding the Holy Land for centuries. So Corey, we've kind of, you know, spilled our bucket on this. We've rattled off a lot of stuff. We're trying to get to Caden's questions. And Caden sounds like the kind of young man who is super curious, and I'm sure we've only scratched the surface of this stuff. But for all of our listeners, hopefully we've opened up a unique chapter of Catholic history. I'm going to give Corey the last word on sort of, you know, tying a bow over this whole thing and summarizing it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, like you said, I mean, this is a complicated period of history with a lot that you can go and read and find out. So if you're interested, I encourage you to do that. And it, undeniably, it's a cool concept that someone would be both a monk and a warrior. And it's a very interesting period in the history of the church. I think it doesn't help us to romanticize it. There, obviously, it was war as hell. And there were things that, you know, were done that were bad, and things went poorly in the end. I mean, the Crusaders were not ultimately able to hold that territory. So don't think of them as some kind of idealized perfect Jedi or something. But at the same time, don't demonize them or this period. Like, they went there, a great many, probably the majority, with religious motives of wanting to help pilgrims and serve the church and serve Christian Europe, Christendom. And I think that's good food for thought for us as moderns who, heck, I don't know if we would have the wherewithal to do something like that if we were called upon to do it.
Yeah, well said. Well, Caden, I hope we at least scratched your itch and scratched mm-hmm. the surface of your question. This is such an interesting and important and rich period of history that you're going to want to do more reading and more research on it. But for all of you listening, hey, if you've got a question about Catholic doctrine or history or art or whatever, and it's something that you want us to answer on the show, then send in your questions. Send them to consideringcatholicism@gmail.com, or you can go to the website, consideringcatholicism.com, leave a message there. And we'll do our best to answer them either on the show or offline. We get a lot of questions and a lot of letters and a lot of stories, and I love them. And we can't get to all of them on the show or all of them in private response, but we get to as many as we can. So please send them in. We'd love to hear your stories, your questions, your comments. Also, would you do me a couple of favors? Number one, would you go to whatever podcast platform that you use, Spotify, Apple, or whatever, and would you give us a rating? That really helps us to move up in the searches, to become more visible, and to qualify for things like sponsorships. And if you have access to Apple Podcasts, would you go there and write a review for us? That does the same thing for us. Also, if you would be so moved as to support the podcast. This is a ministry, and we are trying to reach as many people as we can and help them to consider Catholicism. Would you click the link in the show notes or on the website and consider giving us a one-time or recurring donation? That really helps keep this ministry going. So thank you, Corey. Thank you for...
My pleasure.
Thank you, Caden, and thank you, listeners. And we'll be back soon with another episode.
Mm-hmm.